Today is Wednesday, May 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
The New York Times says it got printouts of Trump's tax transcripts from 1985 to 1994, which it says appears to show he lost more money than nearly any other individual American taxpayer.
That's Associated Press reporter Sagar Magani. We'll have more on this story coming up. Also ahead, a car bomb attack in Pakistan's second largest city kills at least 10 people. And officials in Afghanistan say a Taliban car bomb and gun attack against a U.S.-funded international relief organization kills at least 5 people. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani today said his country will suspend compliance with bans on stockpiles of enriched uranium and heavy water under the 2015 International Agreement on its nuclear program. The United States has withdrawn from the agreement and imposed economic sanctions against Iran, and Rouhani says the remaining signatories have not lived up to their commitments. Today in London, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt. Afterward, he told reporters Iran's announcement was intentionally ambiguous.
We'll have to wait to see what Iran's actions actually are. They've made a number of statements about actions they threatened to do in order to get the world to jump. We'll see what they actually do. The United States will wait to observe that.
Pompeo also said that for the U.S., the focus remains on Iran's ability to develop nuclear weapons.
Iran's decision to depart from the JCPOA for us mostly is about their decision to work on their nuclear program, to create pathways which might reduce their breakout time.
Hunt, however, noted that Britain, China, France, Russia, and the European Union, the other signatories to the agreement with Iran, disagree with U.S. President Donald Trump's administration on the deal.
The U.K. has continued to support the nuclear deal, which is a key achievement of the global non-proliferation architecture, because we believe it's in our shared security interests. But today's announcement from Tehran about its commitments under the deal is an unwelcome step. I urge Iran not to take further escalatory steps and to stand by its commitments.
Under the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Iran committed to hold no highly enriched uranium for 15 years. Iran also agreed to accumulate no additional heavy water. Heavy water and highly enriched uranium can be used to build nuclear weapons. In exchange, Iran won relief from sanctions that had badly hurt its economy. Iran says its nuclear program was only for peaceful purposes, but Washington and its allies have feared it was trying to build nuclear weapons. Well, a bomb attack in Pakistan's second largest city has killed at least 10 people and injured more than 20 others. The bomber is believed to have died in the attack. The Inspector General of Punjab Province said the apparent target was a police vehicle near the gates of a Sufi Muslim shrine in Lahore. The attack took place near an entrance for female visitors to the shrine, the French news agency reports. This is the second deadliest attack at the 900-year-old shrine called Dada Darbar, one of the largest and most visited in the country. A bombing there in 2010 killed 40 people. Since then, there has been a heavy security presence at the important religious site for Sufi Muslims. The group believes in a mystical form of Islam, but is considered heretical by some Islamic groups. Today is the second day of Ramadan, the holy period when Muslims fast from sunrise to sunset. Among the top stories in the world, the U.S. House Judiciary Committee was due to vote today on holding Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress over the Justice Department's refusal to provide an unredacted copy of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on his investigation. South Africans are casting their ballots in a national election overshadowed by years of sluggish economic growth and rampant corruption. And a U.S. appeals court rules the U.S. government can continue to return asylum seekers to Mexico while their cases are pending. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute. In 1998, when Sterling Nesbitt was a 16-year-old high school junior, he took part in a dig expedition in New Mexico's Zuni Basin. During that dig, the budding young paleontologist found a unique and nearly complete skeletal fossil. Today, Nesbitt is now a paleontologist and an assistant professor at Virginia Tech. Nesbitt and his colleagues have recently determined that the fossil he had dug up over 20 years ago is actually an early and tiny relative of the mighty Tyrannosaurus rex. Scientists have determined that the dinosaur they name Susquehannas hazeleye stood nearly a meter high at its hips and was about 3 meters in length and weighed between 21 and 41 kilograms. Despite its diminutive size, Susquehannas hazeleye is said to have been much like its bigger cousin, a ferocious carnivore that ate a diet of small animals. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Officials in Afghanistan say a Taliban car bomb and gun attack against a U.S.-funded international relief organization today killed at least 5 people, including a police guard, and wounded 24 others. Interior Ministry spokesman Nasrat Rahimi said insurgents targeted the nonprofit group Counterpart International, which is a partner of the U.S. Agency for International Development, in the upscale Shahri-Nagar area of the capital city. The Afghan forces killed all 5 assailants in a gunfight that lasted nearly 6 hours. Rahimi would not say whether any staff members of the aid group were among the casualties. The U.S.-financed Counterpart International confirmed its office was assaulted by suspected suicide bombers in a series of explosions. They said, "We are incredibly saddened by this attack and are working as quickly as possible to account for our staff," the group tweeted shortly after the siege ended. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump today belittled a report that he lost more than $1 billion as a New York real estate mogul between 1985 and 1994, claiming it was sport for developers to write off such losses to legally avoid paying federal taxes. In a pair of tweets, the president called the report in the New York Times very old information, a highly inaccurate fake news hit job, but did not dispute that he avoided paying federal income taxes in 8 of the 10 years in question. Associated Press reporter Sagar Magani has more.
The New York Times says it got printouts of Trump's tax transcripts from 1985 to 1994, which it says appears to show he lost more money than nearly any other individual American taxpayer. The president tweets this morning many of the losses were non-monetary and that real estate developers like him were entitled to take massive write-offs and depreciation for tax purposes that would show losses in almost all cases. He says the report's a highly inaccurate fake news hit job based on very old information. His Treasury Department this week refused a House panel request for some of the president's tax returns. Sagar Magani at the White House.
This is VOA's International Edition.
It's Legendary Beats.
Hello and welcome to the weekend. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Have a song that you just love that's about an African city or neighborhood? Well, this Sunday's edition features a full playlist of exactly that. Plus, one of Africa's best young live bands joins us on air all hour long. Makumba.
Makumba is a 6-piece band from Victoria Falls.
Yes, the award-winning group from Victoria Falls, Zimbabwe, hangs out throughout the show, and they perform Song of the Week live. You don't want to miss this. It's going to be awesome. So tune in this Sunday, 15:05 and 20:05 Universal Time.
Well, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence says the United States is lifting sanctions on Venezuela's former intelligence service chief, but warned the 25 magistrates of the country's Supreme Court of possible punishment. He reiterated that all options are on the table to remove President Nicolas Maduro. The audience inside the U.S. State Department for the annual Washington Conference on the Americas remained silent when Pence alluded to possible military action. The vice president did prompt applause at other moments in his speech when he vowed the United States would stand with the people of Venezuela until Libertad is restored. The Pentagon is also dispatching the USNS Comfort, a military hospital ship, to the region in June for 5 months to offer medical care to Venezuelan refugees and others, Pence confirmed. Well, as the Muslim holy month of Ramadan began this week, Muslim Americans of diverse backgrounds and national origins gathered in Islamic centers across the U.S. to break their dawn-to-dusk fast, perform congressional night prayers, and help the poor. President Donald Trump has sent warmest greetings to all Muslims observing the holy month of Ramadan. The White House has been celebrating Ramadan since 1996, but President Thomas Jefferson hosted the first White House iftar dinner in 1805. VOA's Muhammad El-Shenawy takes a look at Ramadan in America.
Perhaps nowhere in the world is the diversity among Muslims as represented than in the United States, where American Muslims have their roots in more than 50 countries around the world. Despite such diversity, during the month of Ramadan, their feeling of unity is especially strong. Imam Abdullah Khouj is president of the Islamic Center in Washington.
People from all around the world gather in one place, and we do all feel like we are one people, regardless of the distance and regardless of the geographical areas.
Muslims observe Ramadan with rituals that bridge many differences. Families shop for halal food, they prepare iftar dinners to break their daily fast, help the poor, and perform nightly prayers in mosques and Islamic centers. But Muslim Americans practice an extra ritual during Ramadan. Imam Shakir Sayyid is the president of Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Virginia.
We host iftar for non-Muslim neighbors right here in the mosque, and we reach out to non-Muslim organizations, churches, synagogues, and other civic organizations to tell them what Ramadan is about.
With the growing visibility and influence of Muslims in the American society, American presidents since President Bill Clinton in 1996 have sent Muslims Ramadan greetings and invited their leaders to White House for an iftar dinner. President Donald Trump has sent warmest greetings to all Muslims observing the holy month of Ramadan. In a statement reads in part, "Throughout this month, we all have an opportunity to reflect on the blessings we have been given and to work toward greater fellowship with one another. Together, in the spirit of Ramadan, we can achieve a more harmonious and respectful society." Last Ramadan, President Trump hosted his first White House iftar dinner.
Tonight, as we enjoy a magnificent dinner at the White House, let us strive to embody the grace and goodwill that mark the Ramadan season.
While annual White House iftar dinners only began a few decades ago, Thomas Jefferson, the third American president, hosted the first iftar dinner in 1805 to welcome the Tunisian ambassador Suleiman Melimeli. Jefferson adjusted the timing of the state meal to after sunset to accommodate the Muslim ambassador's Ramadan tradition. Muhammad El-Shenawy, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Muhammad. Well, rights groups are calling for greater international attention on the Chinese government due to recent cases of alleged rights abuses, including the latest clampdown in Xinjiang to ban Uyghurs, young and old, from fasting or observing Ramadan. They also denounced Beijing's treatment of prominent rights lawyer Wang Guangzhang, who has been held incommunicado since 2015. In Xinjiang, Uyghur households are asked to keep an eye on one another and will receive collective punishment if any of them is found to be fasting, according to a spokesman for the exiled Germany-headquartered World Uyghur Congress. Even local officials or pro-Beijing Uyghurs are monitored to see if they've truly given up their own religious belief and pledged absolute loyalty to communist rule, which sees fasting as a sign of extremism. Well, as a ceasefire between Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza holds, Israel marks its Memorial Day and Independence Day this week. The population has just topped 9 million, and Israelis say they've never had a better friend than President Donald Trump in the White House. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Israelis stood still Tuesday for a two-minute siren commemorating the more than 23,700 Israeli soldiers killed, as well as more than 3,000 victims of terror attacks. All places of entertainment are closed and flags fly at half-staff. At the Western Wall, bereaved families participated in a memorial ceremony. As night falls on Wednesday, the mood shifts dramatically and Israelis will celebrate their 71st Independence Day. For Palestinians, it marks the Nakba, or catastrophe, the day they lost a large part of a projected Palestinian state. Earlier this week, there were heavy clashes between Israel and Hamas in Gaza that left 4 Israelis and 23 Palestinians dead. A ceasefire that went into effect Monday seems to be holding. Israelis say they have never had a better friend in the White House than Donald Trump, who last year recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital and moved the U.S. embassy there. This year, he recognized the Golan Heights, which Israel occupied from Syria in 1967, as part of Israel. President Trump compared the two moves recently.
I was inundated with calls from all over the world, the leaders, mostly the leaders, saying, please don't do it, don't do it. I did it, and it's been done, and it's fine. Golan Heights is the same thing.
Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to bring home the remains of 2 Israeli soldiers Hamas is holding in Gaza, as well as 2 Israeli civilians being held there. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Well, wealthy countries are exporting millions of tons of plastic waste to Southeast Asia, where the recycling systems are becoming overwhelmed, leading to widespread pollution problems, according to an investigation by Greenpeace. The environmental organization says that while wealthier countries boast of their advanced recycling collection systems, the plastic can often end up being exported and eventually incinerated, buried in landfills, or simply polluting the land and oceans. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
50 kilometers outside Kuala Lumpur, in the middle of a palm oil plantation, mountains of plastic waste lay abandoned. Much of it has traveled thousands of kilometers from wealthy countries in Europe and North America. Environmentalist Pua Le Peng says local residents are suffering the consequences.
They just dump the non-recyclable plastic or the reject product, and then they burn in the backyard of this factory. So those toxic fumes actually already cause a lot of health problems to our residents.
Last year, China banned the import of plastic waste, sending a global industry into turmoil. Speaking by Skype, Greenpeace East Asia senior campaigner Kate Lin says wealthy countries are exporting their own plastic waste problems overseas.
They have a good collections facilities, but actually they like sending like half of their collected waste to other countries. Before the China ban, they just send to China for recycling, but they do not take this further step to ensure those recyclable are properly recycled. And now, after the China waste ban, they just find another new places to send their recyclable to.
The Greenpeace report says more than half of that waste, 3 million tons a year, is being redirected toward Southeast Asia, including Malaysia, Vietnam and Thailand.
They do not have the enough capacities for handling such a large amount of import foreign waste. So there is a local solutions to the local environment.
In response, many Southeast Asian countries are imposing their own restrictions on plastic waste imports, forcing the trash into less regulated markets such as Indonesia and India. At a United Nations conference in Geneva this week, 180 countries are discussing a proposal to force plastic waste exporters to receive permission from destination countries in advance, a system known as prior informed consent. Pua Le Peng says for those dealing with the impact, the changes can't come soon enough.
we are killing ourselves by using too many plastic. We too depend on plastic. Please manage and handle your own trash. Don't dump to our country.
Greenpeace says the ultimate solution does not lie in improving recycling, but in cutting back drastically on plastic production and consumption worldwide. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Well, a potential antidote to a potentially lethal box jellyfish sting has been discovered by Australian researchers, from Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The box jellyfish carries enough venom to kill more than 60 people. It's one of the most dangerous marine animals in Australia's waters. Its tentacles have millions of stinging cells. Each one contains a tiny harpoon connected to a venom-filled bulb. The pain they inflict is excruciating and causes skin to die. If the dose of venom is large enough, it can lead to cardiac arrest and death within minutes. Scientists in Sydney have used genome editing, where DNA is manipulated to find a molecular antidote that blocks the symptoms of a sting if applied within 15 minutes. Associate Professor Greg Neely says there have been successful trials on rodents.
That was the eureka moment, is that this is actually could work as an antidote, and it's also safe.
Well, the drug is already known to be safe in humans, so now we just have to basically show efficacy for jellyfish venom. So it could be quickly, within a year or two.
Scientists believe the drug will stop skin dying and the intense pain when applied, but they don't know yet if it will prevent a heart attack. The research has been published in the science journal Nature Communications. However, the Australian Marine Stinger Advisory Service said there was a risk the new therapy could stimulate the stinging cells and cause them to inject more venom into the body and potentially trigger a heart attack. It believes the preferred first treatment for jellyfish stings is vinegar. Box jellyfish are also found in Indonesia, Thailand, parts of Africa, and the Gulf of Mexico. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you, Phil. Well, Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle announced the name of their newborn baby in an Instagram post. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex are pleased to announce they have named their firstborn child Archie Harrison Mountbatten Windsor. And also in the post, it was said this afternoon, their Royal Highnesses introduced Her Majesty the Queen to her eighth great-grandchild at Windsor Castle. The Duke of Edinburgh and the Duchess's mother were also present for this special occasion, the couple said. The baby was born early Monday morning, weighing in at 7 pounds, 3 ounces. The location of the birth was not disclosed. During their first public appearance at St. George's Hall in Windsor Castle today, Prince Harry and Meghan described having a baby as magic. As the prince held his son, wrapped in a white blanket and matching hat, new mom Meghan said, "Well, it's magic. It's pretty amazing, and I have the two best guys in the world, so I can be really happy." The baby is seventh in line to the British throne. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Rob McLean. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel.
host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.